for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. economy created 236,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate dropped to 7.7%, the lowest in 4 years. John Brennan was confirmed as CIA director, and the House voted to keep the government running through the summer. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Michael Scherer of Time Magazine, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, and Manu Raju of Politico. You're invited to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Gene Cummings, just how good are these numbers?
Well, they're completely unexpected. The consensus was there would be about 140,000 to 150,000 jobs. Obviously, we're 80,000 plus above those levels. And so it's a very good job report. It's big enough to bring the unemployment number down a couple of tenths of a point, which it had, you know, hung there at 7.9 for such a long time. And so, you know, this is part of a package of good news that we have seen about the economy in recent months. We have somewhat of a recovery in construction. The Fed said recently that the banks have now put themselves in a position where they could manage a recession because they have enough reserves. We have the lowest interest rates. We have record profits. The one lag had been for a while, this slow hiring that was going on. And so this could be an indication that even the labor market is starting to see a slightly more robust recovery.
What do you think, Michael Scherer?
Well, we have had employment reports with more than 200,000 jobs before in the last couple of years, and they haven't been the signal to that we're going to stay at this level for a long period. So we don't know yet whether this is a new robust economy or not. We also don't know what the impact of the budget talks that are still going on in Washington's going to be. You know, if the sequester stays in place, there's broad consensus among economists that about half a percentage point of GDP growth will be shaved off the economy. And most economists are predicting this year GDP growth around 2-2.5%. So you're talking about 20% of growth over the course of the year. So there's still a lot of uncertainties, but it's clear that the stock market has been very happy for all of this year, in part because of the Federal Reserve helping them out. And the hope for people who own stock, for people in America, is that at some point the real problem with the American economy, which is a stagnation of wages and a loss of employment, begins to mend itself. It's going to happen at some point. We don't know whether it's going to happen this year or maybe a couple of years from now.
Yeah, I think it really adds some urgency to these sequester talks. I mean, the White House knows full well that if the sequester really goes into effect, people will start feeling that in April and May. You'll see folks have to suffer through these furloughs and layoffs, and that could have an impact both on the hiring as well as consumer spending and have a ripple effect across the economy. That's going to really lead to a sense of urgency here in Washington to get some sort of resolution on this issue over the next couple of months.
Michael Scherer suggested the federal government had something to do with this high stock market. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the Federal Reserve's so-called quantitative easing policies, the easy money policies, and keeping interest rates low in the long term certainly have had that kind of impact on the stock market. But, you know, the stock market isn't always the main indicator of how the economy is growing and the strength of the economy. We saw a peak in the stock market in 2007, just before the crash in 2008. So, the very good signs of the job report, as well as housing starting to pick up again, those are much more instructive of the way the economy is going.
Of course, an awful lot of people have been wondering why the job market is not even stronger than it showed today.
Yes, and some of this extended recession had impacts in a variety of ways. one of which was businesses figured out how to continue functioning with fewer employees. In some cases, they made it up the difference with machines. In some cases, they just became more efficient and they didn't need as many people. And these now are built in to the labor market. And so growth needs to come in new areas to create another area of four job growth. And Manu raised a really good point, though, about how the sequester fits into the economic recovery. And if people will recall, last year we started to see some improvement in the job market, going month after month, about 150,000 jobs, sometimes, as Michael said, higher. But the loss of public jobs at the state level,
10,000.
As states were trying to manage the fewer resources and the lingering damage from the economic collapse, they were laying off 30,000 or 40,000 jobs a month. And so there was always this, you know, sort of, you know, one step forward, one step back when we look at the job numbers from month to month. And we could now move right back into that cycle where it's not the states, it's the feds who are laying people off.
You know, one of the things to remember in this, and this is actually the way the White House now talks about it, and you hear it some more from Republicans on the Hill, is that the problem that has with the economy that's most upset voters is this feeling that they are not, their lives are not improving. And that, if you look at the charts, median wages starts flatlining, not even at this recession in 2007. It starts basically 2001, 2002. Job growth goes up a little bit, but wages, the way people are actually living this economy in their homes, in their families, basically becomes a flat line. And we haven't escaped that yet. And I think the real question over the next couple of years is, will the forces, not just in Washington, but the globalization forces, which put a lot of pressure on wages in the United States, return jobs to the United States in a way that allows us to escape from this longer frustration the American people have been feeling?
What about the minimum wage debate, Michael?
That debate is really the White House's attempt to directly address that frustration. It's a very populist policy. It has pretty broad support in a lot of polls. Economists will tell you it's probably not an ideal policy because it may lead to less jobs. You know, if you can only hire so many people and only charge so much for your product, you'll hire less people if you have to pay them more. But it's a very popular policy because that's what the American people feel. They know their paychecks haven't changed for a decade and they want their paychecks to go up and they feel upset about it.
Isn't the negative always what's argued when people talk about raising that minimum wage? You're going to have fewer jobs. You're going to have more layoffs. Small business won't be able to survive.
That's right. You're going to see a big pushback from not only business groups, but also Republicans on the Hill for dealing with the minimum wage increase. That certainly is going to be a top priority item, particularly in the election year, because Democrats see this as a very politically popular measure, something that they could run on as saying that they're trying to help the middle class. So it's a very sensitive topic for Republicans, too, because, of course, over the years, they've been painted as the party that's protecting tax breaks for corporations and the wealthy, and that's something that they're trying to get away from. And when you get into this minimum wage debate, it gets pretty sticky.
Which undoubtedly will be held until next year. I mean, it's basically a political trap. I mean, this is the easiest way the Democrats, you know, they bring it up, you know, in the election year, not this year, next year. And then the Republicans are going to be trapped in that corner. And, you know, as much as we've heard this argument that higher minimum wage means fewer jobs, when we went through this whole debate in the 90s, they made all of those arguments and it didn't have that effect. Now, it may on individual businesses, yes, but on the economy as a whole, it did not lead to a loss of jobs, and the economy did quite well in the 90s. And you look at states like Washington State that has higher minimum wage laws, and they have a very robust economy as well.
Maryland is talking about raising minimum to $10 an hour.
There are a number of states. I mean, I was born and raised in San Francisco, which has a much higher minimum wage than the rest of the country right now. You know, the other debate that comes into this is there are still a number of Democratic economists who argue that the better way of dealing with this is to bring back and improve the earned income tax credit, which is a more targeted way of basically giving a tax subsidy to people who work. directly. It effectively raises their wages, but it's constructed around households as opposed to individuals. So you're not raising the minimum wage of people who don't necessarily need more money to support a family. You're raising it basically by family, the income by family, which is something else that Bill Clinton did in the 1990s.
So the question becomes, is anything going to get done before that election year process begins, Jane?
Well, I think that immigration reform will have to have made some advancement before next year. That, and I think also these budget talks, they've got their deadlines that will approach and force action. And we are in this window where, you know, the talks have started in Washington. They're more robust than they used to be. There are more players at the table than we've seen before. And, you know, as Senator Portman of Ohio, a Republican, said, there is a small window here. Nobody's getting overly optimistic because the differences between the two sides are very real, with the Republicans really holding firm on no more tax revenues and President Obama saying that indeed we will need some. So these could be just simply impossible to bridge,
but
they're talking.
The president did say he's willing to give on entitlements on both Medicare and Social Security. Gene Cummings at Bloomberg News, Michael Scherer of Time Magazine, Manu Raju of Politico. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about dining at the Jefferson. Stay with us. And just before the break, Gene Cummings, you were talking about this slight improvement in what seems to be happening in Washington. Manu Raju, there was a dinner at the Jefferson Hotel this week. Who was there? And who paid for it?
Well, it was Republican senators were there, about a dozen or so, who were dining with the president. I mean, the president has not really done a whole lot of outreach to Republican senators, even Democrats on Capitol Hill, throughout his first term. He senses that the chance that there are very few avenues in getting a budget deal through. And so now he's trying to do this through Republican senators, see who is willing to negotiate with him. But this was more of a social occasion. They were both getting to know one another. They were trying to build a relationship and a sense of cooperation before the real negotiations came in. The White House said afterwards that the president paid out of his pocket, but there's some dispute of that, but that's the White House's line.
So who were there? Who were the big players?
It's those members of the Senate Republican caucus who have signaled over the years that they want to work on a deal, a bigger deal with the White House. So it includes everybody from Senator John McCain and Senators Lindsey Graham to Tom Corker to Saxby Chambliss. There are a group of people, including some who have said, look, I'm willing to put revenue on the table again, even though the Republican Party is against it, who want to try and do something bigger.
Get a deal.
Yeah, get a deal. And I think that, you know, it's sort of very refreshing for someone like me who spends my life covering a very frustrating city, a very broken city. The last week has been, at least by appearances, the way Washington should be.
A glimmer
of a city that actually functions, of people who disagree but actually talk to each other. I mean, this dinner was one of a number of events. Yesterday, the president had lunch with Paul Ryan. About a week ago, he had John McCain and Lindsey Graham over to the White House. He's been making a number of phone calls privately with members of the Senate. Next week, he's planning to go up to the Hill to meet with the Republican caucus in the House. He's also going to have lunch with Republicans in the Senate. So, I mean, this is the sort of actual conversation that we haven't had. And if you notice, at the same time this is happening, the amount of public posturing and noisemaking that has become so typical of the day-to-day operations of this city has really declined. You haven't seen the president out on the campaign trail, you know, like he was just a month ago, you know, talking about how Republicans have to bend. He's talking privately, and maybe they come to some agreement, and maybe they don't. We don't know yet.
So has this required a personality transplant, or what's going on
well,
here?
Well, what it required was the invitation to be made and for it to be accepted. If we should note that the president issued these kinds of invitations in his first year in office, and the Republicans said no. They didn't show up, and in fact, they would brag about the fact that they had turned down the president's offers.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, he made an effort early on. He made an effort last year a couple of times and was rebuffed. And so both sides had to do this. He had to make the offer. They had to say yes. Now we got both sides doing that. Other hopeful pieces of this, if you look at House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the two of them aren't standing in the way of it. And that's really important.
Either of them at the dinner?
They were not. Both of them have said, Boehner has said he's done negotiating. McConnell said his last deal was going to be the end of it for him. However, both of them have encouraged the president to reach out to them, their members, and to build support and bring it up. And so I think what it means is if there is a deal, Boehner and McConnell won't block it. And so that's another really good piece.
I think what we're going to see is this happening more towards almost the regular order of Congress. I mean, what we've seen over the last several years is these negotiations and failed negotiations happen between the Speaker and the President, and those really not going anywhere. And Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden striking a deal at the 11th hour of the fiscal cliff. Instead, what we're going to see is an effort to try to build some consensus through the committee process when the budget actually starts moving in earnest. That process will begin next week when both Paul Ryan and Patty Murray unveil their budgets in the House and the Senate, and it's going to really pick up until we hit up into the debt ceiling fight by midsummer. So we'll see that happen in that
regard.
So
why is all this happening now, Michael?
Well, the simple answer is that the leaders have decided they can't cut a deal by themselves. You know, House Speaker John Boehner has revealed himself repeatedly over the last couple of years as an incredibly weak leader who can't bring his caucus along even on things he embraces. And he's not embracing the president. So it's even harder if he tries to embrace the president. Mitch McConnell is, you know, facing what could be a difficult reelection campaign coming up. Doesn't also want to be seen as the guy throwing his party or their ideals over the edge of the ship. I think so both of them are looking to, I mean, the path for compromise leads through the Senate and it goes to the House and it includes a lot of Democratic votes in the House. So both the leadership in Congress, the Republican leadership, has basically signaled, as we say here, that the White House has to bring the members along and then the leaders will follow.
And the politics have changed in such important ways. McConnell's problem in his reelection is a primary challenge. And so that's what he's got to worry about, is that the Tea Party would put up a challenger to him. So that's a big reason he can't come to the table right now. But clearly he is one to go along with big bargains. We've seen that. And all reports are that Boehner really wanted to make a big deal but couldn't. But he can't do it now either because his speakership might be at risk. So they have done the best thing they can, and that's to step aside and let others try to make this happen. And then for the president, he has a very different argument to make about why it's a good thing, good reason to do it now. It's smart economically. It's good for the country. It could reduce the deficit, and he doesn't get a political win out of it. He gets a legacy, and they get a legacy with him.
It's interesting that yesterday at that luncheon, not only was Paul Ryan there, but Chris Van Hollen was there.
Yeah, that's right. He's the Democrat from Maryland, the top Democrat on the budget committee. Anything that's going to get done here is going to require Democratic support.
Of course.
So the president knows that he needs to keep Democrats apprised. That's why you're not seeing too much concern from Democrats, the leadership right now, for these meetings that are going on with the Republicans. They know that whatever gets done is probably going to have mostly Democratic support with some Republicans. And as Michael said, first out of the Senate, and then if the House would, and then Speaker Boehner will have to decide whether or not to allow a bill to go forward that would be carried with mostly Democratic votes.
Okay, let's talk about the confirmation of John Brennan and what happened before his confirmation, Michael.
Another reason that it was the best week ever in Washington, D.C. A couple days ago, while we were supposed to be having a snowstorm here that never materialized, Rand Paul, Kentucky,
I was here.
Kentucky Senator, took the floor of the Senate in an old-fashioned filibuster. Normally, when we talk about filibusters, it just means kind of quietly, silently blocking things from happening. But the old-fashioned filibuster is you actually go down to the floor of the Senate and you start talking and you don't stop and you don't sit down and you never yield the floor. And he kept it going. I think it was 13 hours. Before he left the floor, he had some help from other members. And his point was a really populist, kind of a bipartisan, pan-ideological issue. And it's that the White House has been very cagey and very secretive about its drone policy. And most specifically, he was focused on what the White House and the Justice Department believes are the president's rights to attack an American on American soil with a drone. It was a very specific issue. And he implied over and over again that there is a possibility here that someone could be sitting at a cafe in Texas having a cup of coffee and then all of a sudden be blown up by a missile that came from the sky that the president authorized. As a populist issue, I think you poll that issue. Do Americans support being able to be blown up without warning by a drone? All Americans are on Rand Paul's side here. The problem is that the president has not in any way...
All right. Here is, in front of me, the Attorney General's letter addressed to the Honorable Rand Paul. It says, "Dear Senator Paul, it has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question, quote, does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil? The answer to that question is no. Sincerely, Eric Holder."
Yes, sir. Eric Holder, you know, was happy to say no to that the next day. But the more interesting development coming out of this was that the next day, Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham came to the floor and went after Rand Paul very fiercely for attacking the U.S. drone program. And all of a sudden, you had this big division exposed within the Republican Party about the way they approach defense policy. And the issue here for McCain and Graham is that, you know, they believe we have to continue to have a very forward-pushing military operation against terrorists overseas. And they think drones are a key part of that. And they don't want this discussion, this sort of domestic fear of drone attacks, to somehow limit what can be done over there. And then all of this is done in the context of a new CIA director's nomination that gets passed shortly after all these fireworks die down in a very strange vote in which you have Democrats voting against him and Republicans voting against him. But, you know, he got passed with, I think, 63
big margin.
Senators.
Yeah, a big margin.
That's right. And I think it also, you know, I don't think this debate's going away, this drone debate. You know, the White House could have probably saved itself some headache if Eric Holder had released that letter earlier this week. But, you know, on that vote, Patrick Leahy, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, voted against John Brennan because he feels that his committee has not been looped in on the administration's legal rationale for the drones program. You also have the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, Dianne Feinstein, saying that she wants more oversight into this program, potentially more legislation. There is a big push, both among liberals and conservatives, people like Ron Wyden. I talked to him yesterday about this. He said that there is a coalition that's building among liberals and conservatives to get more answers out of the administration on this. And it speaks to also this festering tension between the CIA and Congress over its secrecy post 9/11. They really feel they have not been looped into the extent of the agency's programs.
Well, I believe Manu is definitely right. This is the start of a debate, certainly not the end of a debate. And the wings that are coming together, the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, which the Paul family for a long time has been basically the face of, and it's the whole Big Brother fear that, you know, the drones will go up and then next thing you know, they're watching every move that we make. And so as much as Holder answered that question, there are a lot of questions that we still don't have answers to.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got other nominations out there. For example, Sylvia Burwell for budget director. What kind of signal does that send, Michael?
I think it continues to send the signal that the President Obama depends heavily on the staff of President Clinton. She's yet another nominee who was there in the middle of debates during the 1990s, worked on budget and policy for Clinton, worked for Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary of President Clinton, and has worked with a number of other people, you know, like Jack Lew, who was back there during the Clinton days, who are still around President Obama. She's not a particularly controversial nominee. She has most recently been working at the Walmart Foundation. She worked with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But she's someone who has a lot of experience with the kind of budget fight we're going through because she was there in the 1990s when this was happening, and I expect she would be confirmed.
What about the Interior Secretary Sally Jewell?
I don't think that she'll create much of controversy on Capitol Hill. I think that the issues over access to public lands that always come up in these contexts. Republicans, of course, were pushing for more access, but that is not going to be the big fight. On the energy side, on the environmental side, that will be the EPA, the new EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy, who was nominated earlier this week. That is what the Republicans are going to really battle over because over the issues of climate change, in which the president is trying to make a big push for, but we know that he's not going to be able to do things legislatively. This is going to have to go through the regulatory process, and that's what's prompting a lot of concern from Republicans.
All right. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Columbia City, Indiana. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Diane. I was interested in the conversation about President Obama having dinner with Republican senators, and I'm reminded of an episode of The West Wing where Martin Sheen is the president, is trying to get something through with Congress, whatever, and he pretty much by himself goes up the steps of the congressional offices and sits outside a hallway waiting to talk to the leader of Congress. He comes unannounced, and they're not understanding what to do about it, how it would look politically, whatever, and they're talking and talking, trying to figure out what to do with the president who's sitting out in the hallway. Eventually, they wait so long trying to figure it out that the president leaves. And it was quite an interesting episode. I would love to see President Obama walk up the steps of Congress, go and see who he could talk to and who would actually come out of their office to have a discussion with.
How likely is that, Manu?
Well, I don't think he'll be waiting if he goes up to Capitol Hill. He'll be able to walk in right away. You know, the president's visits to the Capitol have been pretty limited in his first term, and I think that's the significance of next week and him going to both House Republican, Senate Republican, and the Democratic caucuses in the House and the Senate, really try to begin that discussion that has really been lacking between the West Wing and Capitol Hill.
And speaking of things happening, there is breaking news that Osama bin Laden's son-in-law has pleaded not guilty to conspiracy to kill Americans. We'll be talking about that more in our second hour. But, of course, there have been some pushback from Republicans on the fact that he was not going to be tried by a military council at Guantanamo. The president's response to that is that it's conspiracy and there is no focus on conspiracy in international law. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The son-in-law of Osama bin Laden faces conspiracy charges in New York. International support grows for Syrian rebels. And Venezuelans mourn the death of President Chavez. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Manu Raju. He's a reporter at Politico. Gene Cummings is with Bloomberg News. Michael Sherry is with Time Magazine. Let's go first to Palm Desert, California. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you. My question concerns the minimum wage. If we complain about the obscenely bloated salaries claimed by executives at the top of the corporate food chain, we might hear conservatives argue that it's not a zero-sum game after all. If the guy at the top takes more, it doesn't mean that there's a limited supply of good stuff for the common folks. If we ask for a higher minimum wage, it's a different story. That's treated as a simple subtraction from business profits that they'll never get back. So I want to keep asking until somebody figures this out.
I think it's a really good question. Manu?
I think that's how the debate will be framed for folks who want to raise the minimum wage, saying, look, folks at the top, their salaries keep increasing. Why? Well, how about folks who are struggling to get by? It's certainly how it's going to be defined. Republicans would counter and say, look, one is the government setting a price. The other is the private sector, and that's the way the private sector should work. So that is how this debate is going to be defined going forward. And mm-hmm. I think that's that the caller's argument is certainly one that'll be raised.
Michael.
And the answer has more to do with the way the U.S. economy and the global economy has evolved over the last decade. I just mentioned earlier that medium wages for regular workers in America are basically flatlined for a decade now. At that same time, you've had this explosion in corporate profits. You have a record Dow. Corporate executives are being paid obscene amounts of money. I agree with that. And they're being paid that because they're corporations are making enormous amounts of money.
Shareholders.
And the reason is that is complicated. There are a lot of factors here, but they have to do with globalization. The regular worker has global competition now in a way that he or she didn't in the 1990s. Has to do with technology, which has pushed a lot of people out of jobs, and has to do with the Federal Reserve, which is pumping money into the economy in a way that improves investment and that it makes people who have good credit able to refinance at very low rates. And people who don't have good credit really stuck in a very difficult situation. So the answer is not just that, you know, one side is wrong and the other side is not wrong. It's that the economy itself has become distorted from its historical norms over the last decade.
All right. Houston, Texas. Good morning, Felix.
Yeah. John, thank you so much. This is my first time calling. And I'm trying to say something about Obama and the cooperation with the Republicans. In the first time, Obama offered the Republicans cooperation. In any contract or cooperation, there's always offer and acceptance. They did not accept the offer. Instead, they went ahead to say that they want to make him one-time president. So Obama can't continue to cooperate with them. Otherwise, it will seem as if he's begging them.
Cooperation now as opposed to previously, Gene.
Well, and that's where I think that the political dynamics are so much different. And Felix makes a good point in that the problem in Washington with cutting a deal is that one side has to let the other side win. And then they take that victory and they use it to try to get reelected or beat somebody else in a campaign. We're at a moment here where Obama's not going to ever run again for public office. So, you know, this is a legacy item. This is something he would like to achieve, as I said, because it's good for the country. It would reduce the deficit. There are lots of good reasons around it. And it also would look really good in the historic books for him. But the Republicans have an opportunity to actually share that legacy. It becomes a legacy for both. And they have long had deficit reduction as their top priority, and they've got a Democratic president who's willing to deal on entitlements. They're not going to see this type of environment very often. This is their window to achieve one of their top legislative priorities as well. So instead of it being just the political dynamics being just about a campaign, just about a reelection year, this is about legacies that both of them could share, and that's what I think is different.
All right. Let's look forward. Jeb Bush suggested this week he might run for president. How seriously?
Oh, wait. He didn't do that. Everyone read his comments to say
he said, I've decided not to think about it for a while. I have the discipline to do that. In the interim, I hope to have a voice that I can share views that might be appropriate.
A crack in the door.
Yeah, a crack in the door.
A crack in the
exactly.
door.
What do you think of that, Manu?
I think that if he entered the race, he would be a very formidable candidate in a Republican primary. You would see that a lot of folks in Washington, the big donor community and establishment types, get behind him very quickly. But he'd also create problems for another Florida Republican, Marco Rubio, who is himself paving the way for a 2016 2016 run. If Bush gets in, does Rubio run? And if he does, Rubio would have a harder time dealing with his Florida donor class because Bush may suck a lot of those folks up. So Bush is really the heavy here, and folks will be watching him closely.
Talk about the Quinnipiac poll, Jean.
Yes, they had one of the first presidential polls for it. For 2016, God bless them. And what they show is that Hillary Clinton stands at the top of the heap. They tested three Ds, three Democrats and three Republicans. And Hillary beats basically all of the big-name Republicans. She's ahead of Governor Christie of New Jersey, 45-37. She's at 50% when it comes to Rubio of Florida and Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. Now, Christie was the strongest among the Republicans, and while he fell to Hillary, he did beat Vice President Joe Biden, 43-40, a little closer, but Christie of New Jersey was at the top of the Republican
pack. So where's Jeb Bush and all
that? Well, he wasn't in that poll.
He wasn't in that poll.
He can take comfort in the fact that polls 3 years out are generally not predictive.
We like them anyway.
Actual results. You know, the thing about Jeb Bush this week is if he is running for president, he had a very difficult rollout. He came out with a book in which he said at one point that he wants the immigration debate to be solved by creating a new legal status for the undocumented immigrants in the U.S., which contradicted what he had said previously, where he said, I want a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants in this U.S. And then he was challenged on that point, and he ended up saying, I support both, either one. I'm not entirely sure which. I just want to make sure that future immigrants don't come here. His message was really rather muddied, and and it positioned himself, and it wasn't clear whether it was intentionally or unintentionally, to the right of Rubio, who is really his mentee, who's gone out on a limb now to say that Republicans should be supporting a path to citizenship. So as the very beginnings of a possible campaign, Jeb Bush got a clear sense this week of how difficult running for president
would be. Is mentee really a word?
I'm not sure. He offered yet another explanation in the Washington Post, in a Washington Post column today, where he was quoted in it, where he said he was writing the book in the middle of a Republican primary in which he would have been on the left of everybody who was in that race. He took a less conservative position. And since the election, the Republican politics around immigration reform have just been turned on their head. And so now he suddenly is to the right of where everyone else has just moved. But that's a problem, lag time of a book, I suppose.
Okay, I want to ask you all about two longstanding, ongoing issues. First, abortion. Arkansas passed the most restrictive ban on abortion this week. It's a 12-week ban that would affect women a lot. Manu.
Yeah, and I don't think that the chances of it holding up in federal court are very high. You know, under Roe versus Wade, the time frame generally is assumed to be about 24 weeks. So this 12-week period probably is not going to hold up in court. We saw earlier this week an Idaho law that had about a 20-week restriction. That was rejected in federal court itself. It really reveals how a split among anti-abortion activists, some who are really trying to push federal courts to overturn Roe, and others who want a more incremental approach. And I think that's what we saw in Arkansas.
Michael.
And what's clear here is that this is another example of abortion opponents continuing to have success on the state level. One of the stories, and Time Magazine did a cover story about this a few months ago, of the abortion debate in America over the last decade is that anti-abortion legislators in states have had enormous success in laws like this. This one won't probably stand up in court, but, you know, restricting conditions where abortion clinics can be, you know, what information mother has to have before an abortion, that have really put pressure in a lot of conservative red states on the access to abortion. The anti-abortion advocates, pro-life advocates, continue to come up with new ways like this one
pushing
to keep pressure on. And so this one probably gets thrown out of the court, but I think it should be seen in the broader context of a rather successful effort on the state level to restrict access to abortion in a number of states.
And I don't think there's a real division between the anti-abortion crowds on tactics. I think that they are all in agreement. Let's use them all. Everything that we could possibly do. And so you have incremental legislation and you have legislation that is designed to go to the Supreme Court. And right now there are so many conflicting laws and decisions out there that indeed, you know, they're going to drive more cases and hope that the Supreme Court ultimately does what they wish, and that's overturn Roe.
And what's holding up gun legislation in the Senate, Manu?
Well, the politics, mainly. I mean, there's an effort to try to get a universal background checks deal among senators, but that bill, probably what has the best chance of passing, has stalled over the issue of record keeping, whether or not retailers who sell guns should be required to keep those records. Republicans don't like that. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma has been a key person in these negotiations with Chuck Schumer, the New York Democrat. Those talks have essentially ended for now. Instead, they're going to still try to find other Republicans who will go along with that effort. Now we're seeing other legislation move forward, including the Judiciary Committee this week, which endorsed a bill that expands sanctions on so-called gun trafficking, in which so-called straw purchases are made when a purchaser buys a gun for someone who shouldn't have one. Those sanctions would be expanded under the legislation. But even that has a tough time of passing. That only got one Republican vote in the committee. Its chances on the Senate floor probably are better, but in the House, it's anyone's guess.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, golly, right after Newtown.
And none of these bills that are advancing would have had anything would have prevented Newtown, would have prevented Colorado, would have prevented the Sikh temple shooting in Wisconsin. None of them. Would have prevented the mass shootings that the American public is demanding action on.
I think the thing you have to understand about what the president did after Newtown, and they said it at the time more quietly than what they said publicly, was this was the beginning of a long fight.
Right.
They were doing a big public relations push after Newtown to try and recalibrate the politics of guns in America. They knew they're always going to have an incredibly difficult time in the House. They proposed things like an assault weapons ban. They knew it really had no chance of passing the Senate, and still has no chance of passing the Senate. But if they do get incremental things this Congress, and there are a lot of outside groups who are spending a lot of money, who intend to continue to spend a lot of money to push these issues, they think that over the long term they can begin to work away at this.
All right, my wonderful producer Lisa Dunn has said the Oxford English Dictionary dates the term mentee to 1965, says it is of U.S. origin. However, it is controversial because some think the word is not a synonym for protege. Little English this morning.
That just barely snuck by there.
Okay, and let's go finally to Sanford, Florida. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Thank you.
My concern is, getting back to the drone issue, is not just the government and their ability to fly drones around, but the private sector as well. We have Google flying over now, taking pictures of our homes. I'm wondering if it's going to be a matter of time before they're taking pictures of our homes and selling pictures of our homes, live view of the home.
And there was a near collision with a commercial plane with a private drone the other day.
And the Federal Aviation Administration has recently released an estimate that there be as many as 10,000 active commercial drones in the air in 5 years. And so
what's the FAA going to do about this?
Well, we're in uncharted waters here. And in addition to the commercial ones, among the unanswered questions left after the filibuster is, what about the police departments?
Yeah.
They're having their own debate.
Right.
And so, you know, while the federal government and the CIA will have certain rules, what would be the rules for, you know, the local police department?
And what
there
happens
are lots
the,
of unanswered
the paparazzi
questions.
In Hollywood get a hold of their first drones that can fly over Beverly Hills and take pictures of celebrities in their houses.
So when you say we're in uncharted waters, do you think that something is going to be taken up soon and seriously?
I think that's what's propelling the push in Congress to try to deal with this. I mean, there's really hardly any, there's no oversight from the legislative branch or even sort of any sort of parameters for how these this program is taking place. There's certainly going to be an effort, but a lot of this is going to be done in secrecy because this program is classified for the most part, and the people that even members of Congress don't know a lot about it. So I'm not optimistic that they're going to be able to get a lot done, but there's at least going to be a debate to figure out how to do just that.
Any last word?
Well, I think that this will be one of the most interesting debates as we go forward because it's law enforcement, it's privacy. You have so many strange bedfellows with the ACLU congratulating Rand Paul, and it's just going to be a terrific debate.
Jean Cummings, she's deputy government editor for Bloomberg News. Manu Raju is senior congressional reporter at Politico. Michael Scher is White House correspondent for Time magazine. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.